From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Government agents might be taking in undocumented immigrants, but there are not enough immigration judges to handle the caseload.
Three immigration judges at Immigration Court in Detroit. We found out about 1 week ago that two of them would be temporarily reassigned.
The U.S. women's hockey team plays in the World Championship in Plymouth. That almost didn't happen because team members boycotted the event.
I trusted in each and every one of these women's ice hockey players that were standing with us.
We'll talk to a researcher who says there is a way to raise beef cattle in a more environmentally friendly way.
We would like the food we produce to be socially just.
And to play the deals with slavery, insurrection, and death.
It is quite a journey, not for the meek, but highly entertaining and necessary.
All that plus Daniel Howes on the future of the auto industry, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The U.S. women's hockey team will play in the World Championship in Plymouth, which kicks off tomorrow night. That was not at all certain because the team was ready to boycott the event because of unequal pay and resources compared to the men's team. Players and USA Hockey managed to avoid a boycott Tuesday night. The deal includes a four-year agreement that pays players beyond the 6 months before the Olympics. Here to talk about that is team member Megan Keller, who's from Farmington Hills. Megan, welcome back to Michigan.
Thank you.
I have to deal with the boycott because it's pretty important. What are the main issues that led to it?
I'd have to say just the overall support for women's ice hockey as a whole and just that equitable support. You know, I work with my teammates and these women each and every day, and they all work so hard, and they deserve this, and we all deserve this. The sport deserves it.
This was a pretty incredible step, and I have to say it was really risky. I mean, if one of the team members had decided not to honor the boycott, or if USA Hockey got replacement players, it would have gone really badly for those of you who stood up for your issues. So why take that risk by boycotting just before the World Championships?
I think it's just a testament to how united this group of players, not just this current team, but the entire player pool and any college players and younger players, how united this group was, what great leadership we had to look up to and trust in. And personally speaking, there wasn't any doubts in my mind going forward because I trusted in each and every one of these women's ice hockey players that were standing with us.
There are still some discrepancies between the benefits that the men's team and the women's team get. What do you think about that?
That's always going to be an issue, but I think this was a huge step for women's ice hockey and women's sports in general, and to just keep working towards closing that gap and just competing hard out there.
U.S. women's hockey team has a really impressive record, several world championships and Olympic medals. How does it feel to be playing in the world championships so close to your hometown?
It's pretty surreal. To be able to be a part of the women's national team and play in world championships is an honor itself. And to be able to represent your country on home ice is pretty amazing and something I can't wait to get started with and look forward to a lot.
Are you expecting a lot more family to be at this championship than in the past?
Yes. So this is actually the first world championship my parents will be able to watch in person. So I'm really excited and hope to do them proud.
Megan Keller is a hockey player for Boston College. She's from Farmington Hills. She's on the U.S. women's team, and they'll be playing in the World Championships, which is being held in Plymouth. Best of luck.
Thank you.
You might have heard from the president's Twitter account that U.S. auto companies have been making some announcements. Daniel Howes' column today in the Detroit News looks at some decisions by Ford Motor Company and what it says about the future of the auto industry in Michigan. Daniel, you write about Ford's investments in three plants, an engine plant, retooling to make the returning Ford Ranger and Bronco. But it's what's happening at that with that third investment that says a lot about what Ford is doing. Where's that investment and why is it important?
It's down in Flat Rock at their plant down there, and which is currently making Mustangs and Lincoln Continentals, kind of traditional automotive products. And a traditional automotive use, but they're also going to be building another data center down there, as well as a capability to build electrified and autonomous vehicles. To me, this is very symptomatic of and symbolic of an industry that is really pursuing two tracks. the major players in the auto industry have got to place a lot of smart bets on the current business, on the cars and trucks that generate the revenue and the profitability. And it also has got to make some smart bets on the future. And those things are not generating revenue and profits right now. They're just basically sucking down investment, but they're playing it. And the other thing that's really interesting is it's happening here in Michigan. It's not happening in California. It's not happening in other parts of the country. As a result of the retrenchment and meltdown in 2008 and 9, the auto industry is more concentrated in Michigan than it's been in an awful long time geographically. So the economy of the state really is going to rise and fall to some extent on how successful these companies are with those bets they're making.
You're talking about investors. There's a lot of competition for investors between other automakers in Silicon Valley. What are the feelings of Wall Street's investors about Detroit automakers these days?
Well, I think there's a lot of skepticism. You know, memories are long in the investment community, and they certainly are familiar with the auto industry spending decades making a lot of promises that they couldn't keep, incinerating capital. These are huge, huge consumers of investor capital. As I saw one analyst recently say, you know, the auto industry eats capital for breakfast. And I think that's true. And the industry knows that, and certainly the investment community knows that. So they kind of look at where we are right now, and despite the fact that the likes of General Motors and Ford are making record profits in North America more than they have at any time in more than 50 years, they're kind of still taking a wait and see approach, because they're battling with Silicon Valley for position in the next generation of the auto industry. And I think a lot of people are saying, you know, until you can prove that you are really going to be a player, we're not going to reward you with higher stock valuations.
After Michigan's lost decade and the Great Recession, there's been a lot of talk about diversifying the economy in a way that we're not so dependent upon manufacturing and the auto industry. How does this play into that?
You're right. There has been a push for diversification. What I think is important to note here, though, is that there's more than one auto industry. And, you know, there's the traditional manufacturing that a lot of people have known for decades. And that continues, although it continues with a lot fewer people. These companies are making a lot of product using very few people, comparatively speaking, from a historic basis. On the other side, they're hiring whole new contingents of people that never would have worked in the auto industry before. You know, programmers and code writers and people that could just as easily go work in Silicon Valley. And now Ford and General Motors, particularly, and Toyota and the German automakers are competing for that talent in ways that they wouldn't have in the past. Those people by default would have gone to Silicon Valley and to the high-tech industry. Now they're coming to Michigan. I mean, it's one of the things you see in Ford's decision to remake a lot of their Dearborn facilities into a more of a campus environment, to invest in downtown and West Dearborn and doing some development work there, because they're trying to make the place more palatable and more attractive to young people. We recently did a story in the Detroit News of a young woman who grew up in California, went to college at Smith, one of the great schools on the East Coast, and is now working at Ford and rides her bike to work. Now, I would submit to you that 10 years ago, that woman wouldn't have considered coming to Ford, because she probably wouldn't have been an automotive engineer type. She would have been some other kind of person. But now there are opportunities for her. And I personally have met young people through sea kayaking, of all things, who have come to the industry from other parts of the country for the sole reason of working on autonomous vehicles.
So bottom line it for us, what does Ford's investments into mobility and autonomous vehicles mean for the future of building cars in Michigan?
I think it's really important. And in fact, both Ford and General Motors are really doing a lot of that investment right here in the state of Michigan. They're not doing it in other parts of the country.
The title of today's column is Three Plants, Two Auto Industries, and One Ford. Daniel House is the business columnist for Detroit News. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
A widely acclaimed author of fiction and poetry, Jack Driscoll has been called a local hero to Michigan writers, as well as a national treasure. His newest story collection is called The Goatfish and the Lover's Knot. Writer Lisa Lenzo has this Michigan bookmark.
It's no wonder Jack Driscoll has been singled out as one of America's greatest writers. The 10 stories in his new book are elegantly written. They're suffused with beauty and mystery and a deep compassion for the rough yet good-hearted people who live in northern Michigan. Driscoll writes, "It's a place alive with millions and millions of glittering stars, where, on clear nights, comet tails burn out right above us in disappearing arcs like tracer fire. It's a place of broken marriages, of mean-spirited stepfathers and missing mothers. It's a place where even those with good intentions betray their spouses and their children. In one of my favorite stories, titled A Woman Gone Missing, Vanessa has been failed by everyone she has ever known. She's left without family, love, companionship, or meaningful work. She has enough money to live on, but not to thrive. The story ends with a surprise, and it touched me so deeply, I had to stop reading and stare off into space for a while. The title story is another standout. It's infused with sexual and familial longing, as well as a deeper kind of love. Wayne is a teenager with a depressed mother and a bitter father. He's attracted to his best friend's mom, Mrs. Levon, who enjoys floating on her back in water surrounded by wilderness. On the last night Wayne spends with Mrs. Levon, they sit in a boat adrift on Half Moon Lake, her wet hair pressed to his cheek while she names the stars. Something about this night will stay with Wayne and infuse his entire life. He'll earn a degree in fisheries and become a wildlife researcher. He'll buy first one cabin and then another on other wild lakes. And he'll share with his children his love for the elusive yet genuine sustenance found in water, in wilderness, in humanity. The immensely rewarding final story in this compelling collection centers on Fritz. He's a 1/4 Ottawa boy who has eyes, Driscoll writes, like night minus the moon. Fritz and his friends decide they must get rid of his mom's new boyfriend, a General Custer lookalike with the sneer of a small-minded bully. Should they blindfold him and escort him to the Quonset huts at the edge of town? Should they ambush him at the railroad crossing? There we'd be, Fritz says, the single high beam of our snowmobile bearing down like a phantom train about to pancake his sorry ass. In the end, Fritz arrives at a clear-sighted and life-changing decision. Afterward, the three boys ride off on the back of the snowmobile that has become their warrior horse. And as they soar over the snow, you'll feel as if you're flying with them, next to Fritz wearing a wolfskin, the horsetail they've attached to cover their tracks, whipping in the wind. Over 40 years ago, Jack Driscoll drove out from Massachusetts and made northern Michigan his subject as well as his beloved home. Since then, he has shown us a landscape both magical and real, filled with love and loss, illuminated by the brilliance of his writing and the stars above.
Lisa Lenzo is the author of two award-winning collections of short fiction. Her latest book, Strange Love, was the recipient of a Michigan Notable Book Award for 2015. Her review is part of an ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can find her review at michigan.org, michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Well, happy 164th birthday to the man who is the personification of the tortured artist. Vincent van Gogh was born on this day in 1853. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell recently walked Cynthia Canty through the life and death of one of the world's most renowned artists.
Even people who don't pay any attention to art know that Van Gogh was once in possession of the most famous ear in art history.
Probably in all of history, period. And there's a great debate. What did he cut off, the entire ear or just the earlobe? And art historians, like any other kind of historians, love to read other people's mail and other people's documents. And recently, an art historian found evidence that only the earlobe was removed, while another doctor's note said that the entire ear was removed.
There's a big difference. That's a big disparity. Why is there that disconnect?
Well, we know even today if you ask two doctors the same opinion that you're going to be looking a long time. This escapes me, and there are drawings for each. Maybe it was so bloody, it was such a mess that he couldn't see quite clearly. Hmm. My favorite part of the ear story is that Van Gogh somehow knew he was going to be quite famous, I suppose, because he took the ear and went to the local brothel that he loved to frequent and offered it either to a prostitute or to a scullery maid, we don't know which, and said, here, this is going to be important, so make sure you save this ear. And it might have been on eBay. I don't know.
And honestly, that sounds like something out of Game of Thrones, I might say. Yeah. And this really is just part of a very long history of very troubled behavior. And I know last year there was an exhibit at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam called On the Verge of Insanity, Van Gogh and His Illness. So what do physician detectives think that was going on with him?
Well, he had a long history of psychiatric issues, from bipolar to, you know, mania and depression. Some have thought he was schizophrenic or he had epilepsy. I like neurosyphilis. I mean, I don't like neurosyphilis, but I like the diagnosis of it, in that he was a frequenter of brothels both in Paris and in Arles. And if you had tertiary syphilis, if you had the third or end stage of syphilis, that could be quite destructive to your brain and cause all sorts of problems. But there is an industry of what did Van Gogh have or what did he not have, and we probably will never know. But very early on in his life, in his 20s, he would have all these obsessions, and his parents urged him. They begged him at the age of 27, go to an asylum, and he refused. Now, no one really wanted to go to an insane asylum. This was not the Betty Ford Center. Or a place like that.
This was the stuff of Dickens' horror novels,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah. And psychiatry was not psychiatry as we know it today. It was the stuff of straitjackets and padded rooms. So he decided he did not want to do that. But after the ear episode, he did indeed go to an insane asylum. And there's actually a wonderful drawing of the men in the courtyard that he did when he was staying there.
And there is also a medical argument over how he died at just age 37.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That was in 1890. And the way the story goes is that he committed suicide, that he shot himself in the chest and then made his way a mile or more to the hotel he was staying at and then died 2 days later. Now, there was recently a wonderful biography of Van Gogh, and the two biographers say, hey, this doesn't make sense. And for example, the bullet wound was not a direct hit, as you would expect somebody pointing a gun towards one chest. In fact, it was at an oblique or an angle. And he never really said he was killing himself. He sort of alluded to it. And these two biographers suggest that Van Gogh had a friend, a young man who lived near him. And the young man's older brother, who was quite the gun enthusiast, used to love to taunt Vincent Van Gogh and drive him quite mad. And so while this older boy, who was 16 years old, had the gun in his hand, he accidentally shot Van Gogh. And then Van Gogh crawled his way back to the hotel, and then he died. But he didn't want the kid to get in trouble.
Okay. That's an interesting theory.
Great story. I enjoyed reading
it.
My answer is I don't know.
What is it about Vincent Van Gogh, do you think, that makes him so fascinating all these years later?
Well, as you said, he's the icon of the tortured artist.
Yeah.
The story is so compelling. And, of course, the artwork is so magnificent. And the way those brushstrokes, they're not just brushstrokes. They're three-dimensional. It's utterly incredible what he could do.
Dr. Howard Markel, PBS contributor and U of M medical historian. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Let's go to the Arthur Miller Theater at the University of Michigan.
You don't have to hit the entire... that would be fine. Listen to me. That would be fine if that's really what the moment was, but I know that you were aware of doing that. It's one thing if that's how it happened. That's not my issue, but don't force it if it's not there.
That's Timothy Douglas coaching the cast at the rehearsal of the play Insurrection Holding History. Douglas is the director of the performance, and he joins us now. That play came out in 1996. It's the work of Robert O'Hara. Set us up. What's it all about?
It's a very complicated journey and a very theatrical play, but at its essence, it's a play about knowing one's history, that without knowing one's history, one cannot really self-identify and move forward in a productive way in the world. And it focuses on Ron Porter, who is a PhD candidate in slave history at Columbia University, and he is stuck on his thesis when he realizes, it dawns on him at the play's opening, that his great-great-great-grandfather, whose birthday we're celebrating, who is turning 189 years old, yes, he's still alive, Ron finally realizes that his grandfather was a slave and that this is the perfect subject for his thesis. And what's really remarkable right out of the gate is that Ron, pretty bright guy, that talk about not knowing your history, doesn't realize his grandfather's right there. And
I want to play a little bit about, as Ron's talking about his thesis, he's struggling with the whole idea of what he should be doing.
For some reason, I got it in my crazy head that Nat Turner was it. I mean, who the hell needs another paper on slavery? No offense.
Prophet Nat.
Yeah. I don't know where it came from, but I can't get it out of my head and have nothing new to say about him or slavery. There's nothing new about the fact that he lost his mind, started slashing folks, and okay, we survived. Okay already. I mean, so what? Throughout history, millions of people have survived horrible events, and American slavery is minute when you think about it in terms of what happened during the Crusades and even the, I don't know, I mean, Turner's revolt was nothing compared to how those brothers and sisters were kicking up in Haiti. I mean, Nat Turner, slavery, big deal, move on, but it won't let me go.
So I think we need a history lesson real quickly. Remind us who Nat Turner was.
Nat Turner was a slave. He was a slave who learned how to read, and he was used as a tool by his owner to preach the gospel as dictated by his white slave owner to other slaves to keep them down, to keep them calm. But Nat Turner, through his education and self-actualization and reaching his peak of the brutalization of his people, actually used the Bible and the teachings to inspire an uprising of the slaves. The Nat Turner insurrection in 1836 happened, and the plan was to organize, which was unheard of and extraordinary at the time, to organize slaves from within and just start the retribution, as Nat Turner says in the play, killing every white face we see. Now, what happened, Nat Turner believed he was chosen. He was he believed in God choosing him and that there would be a sign. God spoke to him. There's a sign when the uprising would happen. He talks about the moon turning blood red, and that is what he took as his sign. The night of the insurrection, there was a lunar eclipse.
Hmm.
And of course, not knowing, if you know, I'm assuming he didn't know his sciences, even though he could read. And boy, that seems like a pretty big sign if you are truly driven and motivated and believe that God is using you as his vessel.
And as I recall, more than four dozen people were killed.
Yes.
And then the retribution by the white people was pretty indiscriminate.
Many, many, many more blacks and slaves were massacred.
Anyway, this play won the Oppenheimer Award for Best New American Play in 1996. It's been billed a Roots meets the Wizard of Oz. What does that mean?
Robert O'Hara, the playwright, is very open about the structure and journey of the play being inspired not only by those two movies but also Gone with the Wind. In order to frame the history of slavery through Ron's contemporary and myopic perspective, his grandfather takes him on a time-traveling trip back to the plantation, but it resembles, I won't say fantasy, but this kind of distanced, detached that many young people today have about slavery. We kind of know about slavery. It is not formally taught in most of the schools anymore in America. And so there's this double-edged conundrum that, as I said, the play is important about emphasizing knowing one's history. Slavery is a fairly dark history. We would all agree upon that. But it's important that we know about it because I believe still many of the challenges between relationships between blacks and whites is still a source of our unresolved issues around slavery. But then I look at young people and the cast that I'm directing, and it's a wonderful group of people, smart, and getting along across racial lines. And I think that's a beautiful thing. But then I think, but do you know your history? Are you digging deep enough into your own lives and your interactions toward a true self-actualization? I don't know. Maybe they have. I'm old. I was raised, you know, coming up as a kid during the civil rights movement. It was very active in my house and around me. But maybe the young people have worked it out. I don't know. I don't think so. And I do have a responsibility to point to the education, but in doing so, I'm stirring up very uncomfortable and ugly feelings. So the play attempts to teach that lesson, to provide that opportunity to look at our history, but O'Hara's style and the brilliance of his writing does it in a very theatrical way, lends the tone and the journey of Hollywood and the fantastical journey of Dorothy through the Wizard of Oz, and the plantation in 1836, if you will, becomes Ron's Oz. The play is very irreverent at times, very, very funny. The play is complete with a Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead type number when the plantation owner is killed while out in his field by a flying bed that lands on him. That's the vehicle for the two time travelers. Hysterical, very funny. And then within minutes, you're dealing with a very real confrontation between the maniacal overseer and the slaves while he's weighing the cotton. And there's one slave who doesn't have enough cotton picked, and there's hell to pay. It is quite a journey, not for the meek, but highly entertaining and necessary.
You know, often a perception of a play changes as the times change, and you've been able to watch that. How are audiences receiving it today, and how does that differ from in the past?
The last time I directed it was in 2007. This is pre-Obama administration. It's a wild ride, and depending on – this is my unofficial observation depending on the makeup of the audience, if the audience is at least 40% African American, it's a very different journey when it's less than 40% African American. Any adventuresome theater goer goes on the ride, but often I find a majority white audience doesn't know that it's okay to laugh at certain things. And that's it's okay with me and the cast and the playwright if they laughed at it. But certainly the hesitation to laugh is a DNA recognition that we're still living with this atrocity, whether we want to admit it or not. No matter what the response is, though, the play is very compelling and tells a story about family that anyone can relate to. And then it depends on one's own relationship to the perception, awareness, and history of slavery determines how deep the response to the play is. Now, we've been through 8 years of Obama and a very short period of time, and I won't get too political, that our current administration seems to be undoing, from my perception, any progressive forward movement on race relations in America, on gender specifics. Ron happens to be gay, and that's another element of the play and folds in how our American perception of homosexuality has created another potent minority that has had great progress, and now we seem to be heading back into the dark ages. The play speaks to what's happening in America at any point in time, but I cannot answer your question because it's been since 2007. I don't have a clue as how this audience is going to respond.
I can only think that with race being present in everybody's mind because of, you know, Trayvon Martin and Ferguson and everything that's happened in the last 3 or 4 years, it's going to be a different response, I would think.
It'll be a more potent response. And from my perspective, the issues surrounding race in this country have not changed. Certainly there's been progress, but the fundamental issues that we have remain the same. What is different now is that it's back out in the open again. It has been stirred up again, but the source of it, from my perspective, is not different. So, again, the play is going to do what it's going to do, but depending on how not comfortable is not the right word, but how willing any audience member is willing to give themselves over will determine whether they experience the play in real time while it's happening in front of them or holding their breath through most of it and will process it after they leave. But it will have an impact.
Tell me about working with this cast at the University of Michigan.
The University of Michigan Theater Program is one of the finest in the country. This is my third project with them over the years, and I always have a fantastic time. These students are bright, energetic, inexhaustible. And what is a particular thrill for me is because of the makeup of the student body at University of Michigan, but it's all across the country, the black students are a true minority. So we finally have enough students to really do justice to a play like Insurrection. So within the exercise of me being a guest director, directing the students in one of their productions, there's this added experience of the students of color for the first time in their training in performance, getting to source culturally specifically. as opposed to a white Western European model, which is the thrust of how we train actors and what mostly ends up on our stages in America. What's beautiful about it is these actors are so gifted and they can hold their own alongside their white student counterparts when performing roles not written for their race. But the innate, connected, unbridled joy of the authenticity of being present in the moment, not having to talk it through, not having to think it, just pure experience, how that lends to the exuberance of the performance, such a joy for me to be a part of.
The play is Insurrection, Holding History. It's being performed through April 9th at the Arthur Miller Theater at the University of Michigan. Timothy Douglas, it's been a real pleasure. Nice to have you on here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Americans eat a lot of hamburgers, but is the standard approach to raising beef cattle sustainable? We'll speak with an MSU researcher who's exploring an alternative option. And the bottleneck of immigration cases in Michigan might be getting worse, as two of the three immigration judges in our state have been temporarily reassigned. That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
As you probably heard, everyone from Michael Pollan to climate change experts have suggested raising cattle for beef is hard on the environment. The amount of resources that go into producing a pound of beef are a lot greater than what it takes to produce a pound of chicken, for instance. Plus, in some cases, transporting beef further adds to its carbon footprint. We saw a story recently in Traverse magazine that caught our attention, and today's guest on The Next Idea is a researcher who says there are ways to reduce the environmental impact of raising beef cattle. Jason Rowntree is a researcher in animal science at Michigan State University, and he joins us now. We usually raise grain-fed beef in big feedlots. What are the concerns about how we raise beef today?
First of all, from a standpoint of overall feedlot management, is that when we compare feedlots and the production of beef as to pork or poultry, it's a less efficient model. It requires more energy per unit red meat that enters into the system. So that's number one. Number two is the grain that takes to produce the beef coming from the feedlots has to come from somewhere. And ultimately, that has led to decreases in soil carbon, which we're seeing greater challenges with eutrophication. We also are seeing...
What's that mean?
Oh, excuse me. Yes, eutrophication, greater amounts of sediment and minerals, including phosphorus, that are entering the water bodies that are creating hypoxic zones. For instance, what we see in Lake Erie today, especially outside of Toledo. That means likewise, though, that agriculture are working to address these challenges. We're aware of them. But there are some challenges in terms of our existing food models.
What are you doing differently?
We are really approaching our research from a standpoint of an ecological worldview. We want our production models to be profitable for the people in the state of Michigan and elsewhere. But concurrently, we want to be able to see these models be ecologically regenerative, that we're actually improving landscapes we're growing food from. And then finally, we would like the food we produce to be socially just, and the fact that nobody is getting the short end of the stick in terms of food production, that we can have a model that will not harm our earth or harm Michigan in terms of water quality and other things. And so thankfully, Michigan State has been very supportive of our work. We have a research center, Lake City Research, that is dedicated to looking at these potentially old but now regenerated ways of producing food and using cattle to harvest sunlight and to take advantage of some of their really neat specific attributes of being able to digest forage into making protein.
Right. So you have grass-fed beef. We should explain that. Why is that better for the environment?
Well, I think anything when we look at a food system to say one is better or worse, I think it really boils down to the very logistics of the model, the locality, and other things. And so it's much more complex than looking at one versus the other. What I can tell you is the research that we see in Michigan is the fact that through our management, we can graze cattle In fact, it takes us around an acre and a half to produce one grass-fed steer. We get roughly about a 650-pound carcass weight that equates to, you know, 350 to 400 some odd pounds of product. But the point of our model is that we can do that while dramatically limiting our inputs. We do not use nitrogen fertilizer in these models. Likewise, after 6 years of monitoring, we're seeing big gains in our soil carbon. And so it also lets us know that we can produce this food, but likewise, we're bringing CO2 out of the atmosphere and we're putting it back where it belongs in the soil.
So does it take more land to produce beef this way?
It can, yes, sir. But I think the thing that we typically use and the thing that we think about with land use is we only look at it from a standpoint of acreage. Do we look at what's going on per unit land or per unit acre? And while our research would suggest that a grass-fed model in Michigan, for instance, may take probably potentially an acre more per animal to grow that food, I think we need to likewise be mindful of the ecosystem services that are being gained, such that even in a way that even if it does take up more land, as long as that land isn't being used for row crops and other things, it may be an added extra benefit to having those cattle on the land, such that it may take more land, but everything we're seeing is improving the land. So the more we see this system on the land, in fact, the better the soil, the greater the water retention. So we get some added benefits from it.
People who are skeptical about using the approach you're talking about say, we don't have enough land in the U.S. to produce the amount of cattle that we consume to do it this way. What's your response to that?
First of all, my response is that when we go back and look at the onset of the Green Revolution, some really great research from Rattan Lal at Ohio State published in Nature would suggest we've already lost over half of our topsoil that we had going back to the 1950s, for instance. So as we look at the aspects of land, I would like to shift it from a standpoint of not just looking at the amount of land, but what's going on land. And so ultimately, some of our systems may potentially take more, but likewise, are they adding benefits to society? And one of the main challenges of agriculture from a holistic lens is we have not accounted for the unintended consequences of our decisions. And so because of that, if somebody says, well, it takes more land and we're already pressured, I think we need to move away from this land and feeding the world by the year 2050 and really begin to look at it more from an ecological view. Is that, are we being good stewards? Are the decisions we're making and the policies we're making, are they actually improving land? Are we able to see more water retention? Are we losing or are we gaining in terms of water use efficiencies? And so I really would like to structure the conversation in a different lens. Now,
I understand the benefits. What I'm asking you is, practically speaking, could we switch from feedlot to grass-fed beef and produce enough beef at the rate we consume it?
So I think the answer to that is in certain geographical areas, there's no doubt in my mind that we can institute systems that are pasture-based and grass finishing that could be very competitive with grain-fed models. Now, when we look at certain areas out in the West, that's not going to happen. And so from a standpoint of looking at our models, and looking at the fact that in certain geographical areas with adequate rainfall and certainly with management, we can see these models be very competitive with our conventional models that are seen today.
There has been some pushback by the beef industry. How have beef cattle producers reacted to your research?
That's a great question, and I have found the Michigan cattle industry to be very supportive. I don't look at it as a us versus them. I look at it as a system that we are growing. There's a growing demand for grass finishing of beef. But concurrently, just recently, we're learning that McDonald's has been very interested in some of the research that we're putting together. And likewise, they're interested to see what types of improvements in soil can be made on cow-calf models that are typically raising cattle to go into the feedlot. And so our industry has been very supportive here in the state.
Jason Rountree is an associate professor of animal science at Michigan State University, and he's researching ways to better raise cattle so they have a less impact on the environment. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yep. Take care.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been picking up more undocumented people, but processing their cases is hitting a bottleneck. There are not enough immigration judges to handle the additional caseload. Joining me now is immigration attorney Megan Moore. Michigan just lost some of its immigration judges. How many did we have, and why did the Detroit court lose some of them?
Well, there are currently three immigration judges at Immigration Court in Detroit, and we found out about 1 week ago that two of them would be temporarily reassigned to hear southern border cases. I'm not sure if that's people who are being caught along the southern border or undocumented people already in the United States who are being detained, but for whatever reason, there was a shortage for those cases. So in order to accommodate the need for those detained cases to have a judge hear them, the immigration judges here in Detroit, two out of the three were temporarily reassigned. We don't know how long it will be. It could just be this week. We haven't received any other word.
Even with three judges in the Detroit office, there's quite a backlog of cases. Can you describe what kind of waits and periods we're talking about?
Well, there's two types of cases. There are detained cases and non-detained cases. Immigration judges and the public and the government have an interest in getting the detained cases in and out more quickly than not. So those cases usually take priority, and those cases can last a couple of weeks to several months, even a year if there are appeals involved. Non-detained cases can take years. We have clients who have been in removal proceedings since before 2010, 2011. We have a client whose final trial was supposedly going to be this week. He was waiting since 2012, and it was one of the ones that was canceled and will be rescheduled. We don't know for when, but we're seeing them scheduled for as far out as 2020 and 2021.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
If we have these long periods of time before there are hearings on these detained undocumented immigrants, are they being held someplace that entire time, or are they being released and just waiting?
No. So that's where the difference between the detained docket and the non-detained docket comes in. Most immigrants will be eligible to ask an immigration judge for a bond to be released. If they're not given bond or for whatever reason under the law don't qualify to receive bond, they stay in the detained docket and their cases receive priority. So those cases are not the ones you would see that are pushed out to 2020, 2021. It's the people who are out on bond or have been released on their own recognizance by ICE who are waiting all these years for their court hearing.
I understand if they're detained, undocumented people might not even be detained around here. What's that about?
I think it really has to do with space and the ability of ICE just to house the inmates. There just are a limited number of beds. There are a limited number of facilities in the state of Michigan that ICE has agreements with that can house immigration detainees. So if those beds are filled, they have to look elsewhere.
So they're using county jails or things like that for detention?
Yep. They have contracts with local jails to provide those services.
So if they are out of beds in this area, what happens then? Where do they go?
They could really go wherever. We just saw, unfortunately, a group of people be arrested in a raid in Detroit who were sent to a detention center, I believe, in Ohio. And their court cases will be heard then by judges in Kansas, I believe. So it's...
Wait, hold on. How does that work? They're arrested in Detroit, they're housed in Ohio, and they're being heard in Kansas.
I really think it's a matter of just the pure volume that the courts are seeing right now, and where there are judges free to, where are there are beds for the detainees, and where the courts can most accommodate those people facing deportation.
Well, how does this communication go on? Is this all done over a closed circuit TV or a phone,
yep,
or what?
So it will be between the immigrant facing deportation in removal proceedings and the immigration judge. Usually, if they're detained, they're over closed circuit television. So the judges who were in Detroit reassigned to hear cases on the southern border, I don't know this for certain, but my guess is they didn't actually fly to the southern border. They had their courtroom in Detroit, and they were just using a television to see people who are detained in Texas, Arizona, and California.
So if you're from Detroit and you're in a detention center in Ohio and you've got this hearing before a judge in Kansas, where do you get a lawyer?
It really causes concern. Access to counsel and an attorney and legal advice is a huge concern in situations like that. So you will have potentially the family member of the person who's detained living in Detroit or the Detroit area, who then would have to travel several hours to visit their family member. And then where do you hire the attorney? Do you hire an attorney where the family is, where the detainee is, or where the court is? And there are a limited number of organizations that are able to offer pro bono legal assistance for immigration court cases. So you're looking at families who are then having to spend a lot of money to hire an attorney who's either going to be driving from Ohio to Kansas or an attorney in Kansas, and the family is then spending money to drive, you know, to Ohio and then to Kansas if they want to be with the, in the court. So it's difficult. It's very difficult.
I want to talk about why this is happening. There was already an increase in deportations under the Obama administration.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay.
Correct.
So we already knew we had this bottleneck problem. Was there a plan to recruit more judges to become immigration judges?
I'm not familiar with any plans specifically to hire immigration judges. I know that immigration judges were not part of the federal hiring freeze that was put into place by the new administration in January. So there is the potential that there would be new judges hired. And I think that what we're going to see is that it has to happen. It's not the system as it is right now is not sustainable moving forward like this.
There's the assumption that this increased ICE activity is caused by a policy change by the Trump administration. Is that true? And if it is, exactly what changed?
What changed really was, as you said, the Obama administration did deport many people. The difference is, under the Obama administration, there were priorities. You could actually look at someone's immigration and criminal history and tell them you will likely be detained by immigration, or you have a fairly good shot at not being detained or removed or have any trouble with immigration. What the Trump administration has done is issued an executive order, and then the Department of Homeland Security issued a memorandum implementing that, which basically wiped the slate clean. Whereas before you had these somewhat delineated priorities for enforcement, now the door is wide open. Basically, if you are here and you are undocumented, either having come to the country without permission or overstayed a visa, then you are fair game for immigration to pick you up. And what we're seeing, I don't know that we have enough data to know that any of what we're seeing is due to these changes. I think that that remains to be seen.
This is not what President Trump said he was going to do, though. He said he was going after the bad hombres. He was going after the criminals. And we've been hearing many cases where there were no criminal charges. So is this an interpretation by ICE, or is this the executive order went farther than the president indicated?
I think it's an interpretation by ICE. In Michigan, driving without a license is technically a misdemeanor. So you could have someone who's lived here for 20 years. So in ICE's eyes, they could use the new executive order and the implementation memo to say, you are a criminal and we will detain you and put you in removal proceedings. It really poses some very tough questions, and we're going to be facing them just nonstop for the next 4 years. And I think the immigration advocate community is hoping is that it will educate the public, and the system we have is not sustainable, and there has to be real change. We're going to be hearing more and more of these stories of these quote-unquote bad hombres that are detained and removed who, according to the average person on the street, have absolutely no problems at all and are contributing members to society, pay taxes, work hard, and support their families. So it's going to raise a lot of interesting questions, and I think people are going to have to make some decisions internally about how they feel about this kind of thing.
That's Megan Moore. She's an immigration attorney talking about what's happening in this bottleneck because of a shortage of judges for immigration deportations. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.